there, Shopomaniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm 80s radio star Shadow Stevens. And with me is Chris Coyer. Hi, Chris.
Hey!
What happened?
Oh, I'm just feeling at the middle of things today, you know? I just feel very balanced and, I don't know, just like I'm at the center of the universe, really. How are you feeling?
Well, I feel like my daughter coughed in my mouth and now I'm sick, but that's a story for another time. Who we got in studio today, Chris?
That'll happen. Well, we have an extra special guest, Jessica Ivins. Hi, Jessica. How are you?
Hello, folks. How's it going?
I am excited about this episode because Jessica works at a very cool place in a very cool city, Chattanooga, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep, and the place is, as I was joking, middle. It's actually called Center, right? Two alternate spellings of the word center. But, you know, the name is interesting, but tell us about the school anyway. It's like a real brick and mortar place, isn't it?
Yes. So Center is located in Chattanooga, Tennessee. We provide a full-time on-site program that lasts for 2 years. And when you attend as a student, you graduate as an industry-ready UX designer with almost 2 years of work experience, with a portfolio under your belt, with projects under your belt, and you are ready to join a UX team and get to work on day one.
This is happening all over the world, is that there's these things popping up. You know, some of them are mega super VC backed and there's 200 of them all over the world. And some of them are, you know, that they kind of take over a region or they're just in one country, another country. And some of them are online only. And some of them have a few brick and mortars, but have an online program. And rarer are they all brick and mortar like you are. And you just happen to be one that's just kind of one location and started there. And then some of them are like, I don't know, super JavaScript focused or super, I don't know, focused in different ways. And Center is focus, you'd say, then is UX design. You're not afraid of using the word UX anyway. That's the kind of the core of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we focus on UX design. So when you're a student, you're prepared to be a well-rounded UX generalist.
Yeah, right on. And, you know, who knows why I'm sure you have a strong grasp as to why this is, you know, a situation in the world. I think there's a lot of people point to like kind of a labor gap, right? Is that there's just so many people, like companies hiring and can't hire fast enough for these specific kind of technology focused skills. And apparently universities aren't pumping them out fast enough. So let's circumvent normal universities perhaps and make a new learning style. But isn't it true that Center like kind of is a real university though, isn't it? Isn't it accredited in a way that some of these other ones are not?
So we are much more on the vocational side than we are on the academic side. We've designed our program from scratch, from the ground up. And we did a ton of research into developing our program before we could even call ourselves a school. And in that research, before we designed the school to be what it is, we talked with, now I say we, this is before I was hired, going back to the days of my co-founders, Jared Spool and Leslie Jensen Inman, when they were putting the school together. They spoke with dozens, if not hundreds, of hiring managers to learn what these UX hiring managers wanted in candidates, especially more junior candidates, people who are right out of school. And these hiring managers, they didn't care where you went to school, what degree you had. They wanted to know, can you do the work and can you join a team and contribute from day one? So that's when we realized that what we needed was that the conventional options out there weren't really going to work for us, like the boot camps and the universities, right? We felt really weren't going to meet the goal of preparing somebody to be industry ready and ready to work on day one. So that's why we designed this program from scratch. And again, it's much more on the vocational side than the academic side. So we designed it to be much like a workplace. So I am a faculty member here, but I'm sort of more of a manager and project manager and coach than I am a conventional educator. So the students report to either me or my colleague, the other faculty member. We manage the projects. We coach students along if they're struggling with learning something. We give them the support that they need, just like a good manager would do. So by the time you graduate as a student, you are used to this work-like environment. And that way, when you go into the work environment, it's not a huge transition like it would be from other conventional educational
There's a lot of focus on this. You do real work here, right? Like 75% of your time is doing that. So it's less like, okay, it's Tuesday, you know, get your JavaScripts out. We're going to do bubble sort today or whatever. And then, you know, on Friday, please turn in your bubble sort assignment. It's more like, what's an example project like? Is it like, I don't know, the sandwich shop down the street needs a online ordering system? Let's build them one.
No, it's a much bigger project than that. So again, our goal is to prepare you to be industry ready by the time you graduate. And we decided to focus on preparing students to be industry ready for an in-house team, like an in-house design team, because we saw the trend coming years ago, how a lot of UXers now work in-house, where, about 5 or 10 years ago, a lot of UXers were working at agencies and companies were hiring agencies to come in and do the UX work. But there's been a shift where a lot of companies now are building their UX teams in-house. So we bring projects to the students that are from larger organizations that are looking for additional UX work. So we tell organizations that give our students projects, it should be something that's important, but something that's maybe been on the back burner for a little while, that's not hypercritical. Like because they're students, we wouldn't want them to get a huge high profile project, but we also want them to get something
like
that's important.
A student haircut is always a little discounted, you know?
Yeah, because they're learning, right? You got to learn somehow. I mean, to be a good hairstylist, you got to start somewhere.
These
right?
are not fake projects. They are not like, let's invent a problem and invent a solution to
Correct.
The fake problem. You're partnering with real businesses who give you their back burner projects for real students to do, which brings a whole air of responsibility and like this is straight up real.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
Cool.
What kind of students do y'all accept? I mean, is it like you take them from zero to like professional, or do you like have portfolios, or how do you, can anyone jump in this field? Is that kind of your goal, or like, or are you looking for like certain types of candidates?
Yeah, great question. So to attend Center, we have a few requirements. You have to be at least 18 years of age. You have to be fluent in English. You have to be either a permanent resident or a U.S. citizen, because right now we're not yet set up with the government to take students who are international unless you're a permanent resident or a citizen. And a few other requirements. But other than that, we don't require any previous design experience. We do have a very thorough admissions process, which is much more like a conventional job interview process than a conventional school application process.
Really? Like, do we think you're cut out for this in a way?
Exactly. Yeah. We use behavioral interviewing. We ask a lot of questions. We ask for a lot of examples. The things that we look for in our applicants are self-learning. So are you the type of person who is used to teaching yourself things? Are you open to teaching yourself things? Because as you probably know, to be successful professionals in this field, you have to hone the skill of self-learning, because this isn't the type of field where, you know, you sit around for 2 years and then go to a class and then learn something and then you need to know. Then you have everything you need to know for the next 2 years. And
heck,
there's
yeah.
just a
so
lot
this
of
is
self-learning
clutch.
Involved. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is so important.
And it's really hard to teach somebody self-learning, but if they already have that as a skill and a habit, then we can teach them to be a designer, right? If that makes sense.
Well, let's focus in on that a minute. That's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. So you can't.
Yeah, this might be the rest of the show.
Well, you can't. So you can't promise to deliver someone self-teaching. Like like you just said, like I'm just repeating what you said. I didn't mean to like put words in your mouth or anything, right? You're kind of saying like, it feels funny to say though. Is that like you kind of either have it or you don't kind of thing? Or what would you suggest to somebody who feels like they struggle with that? Like, well, I don't know how to learn, you know, or whatever. I don't know how to be a self-starter.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked this question because, you know, conventionally for me when I was younger growing up, I was a very good student, right? But I was a very good student in the traditional way where you pay attention in class, you take notes, you study, you get an A on the test, you do your homework. And, you know, and that works really well for an academic environment, but it doesn't necessarily translate to an environment like the field that we work in where you don't have that kind of structure around you to make sure that you are learning what you need to know, or it's up to you, or you have to go out and learn it. And it was a skill that I had to learn on my own. And it was really intimidating to me at first because it just wasn't a muscle that I had built up, right? But it's something that I started to build up and I started to get more comfortable with. And now I'm at a point where I feel much more confident in my ability to learn. And I'm able to model that for my students as well, because we do make sure that they have that skill under their belt before they come on. But we really want to instill in them how important it is to keep learning, because even though they're here for 2 years, we still can't teach them everything because there's so much to learn. And the field evolves so quickly that once you feel like you've learned something, a month later, 6 months later, you're going to have to learn a new thing or learn this thing that's changed or adjust the way you do things. It's just the nature of the field. So yeah, it's a very important skill to have. And I think if any of your listeners out there don't have it yet, it's like training for a marathon, right? Assuming that you're healthy enough to train for a marathon and run a marathon, you can go from zero to marathon as long as you put in the work and you're smart about how you do it, and you train and you run and you reflect on how your run went and so on and so forth. You know, you can, over the course of a few months, you can become a marathon runner. It's the same thing with learning, like any skill. Like, you can grow your skill and you can go from zero self-learning skills to being a strong self-learner in a matter of time.
There's so much more to talk about here, but if you were interviewing someone and their job was to run a marathon and you just kind of got the vibe that they just didn't really care about, like, they're like, yeah, it'd be cool to run a marathon. And then you're like, I'm not really feeling it, yo. Like, tell me why you want to run that marathon. Like, would that be what you're kind of on the lookout for? Like, you might interview a potential student and they're just like, I don't know, UX seems cool or something. How do you suss out that they're not a good
self-learner sign?
So we look for, with all the skills that we look for during the admissions process, we ask for past examples. And that's behavioral interviewing, if you're familiar with that. It's a great interviewing technique because past behavior is usually a good indicator of future behavior. Like, if you've done X well in the past, you will likely do X well again in the future. So we ask them, you know, tell me about a time where you had to learn something on your own. Right. And most of the applicants that we get, by the time they decide to apply to us, because it's a big commitment to attend for 2 years, most of the people who end up applying, we find right away that we're able to get examples from them because they decide that they're a good fit for us. And so it is pretty easy for us to find the evidence that we need in that regard. But again, we ask for past examples, like, tell me about a time where you had to learn something new. Tell me about a time where you had to learn something on your own. And we hear some really great stories. And the evidence that we look for, it could have nothing to do with design. It could be one applicant told us about how he learned how to change the brakes on his car and the process that he went through and how he had to iterate and he made some mistakes, but he kept going with it. He had to go back to the auto place and exchange the brakes that he bought because he bought the wrong brakes or the wrong tool or something like that. And by the time he finished, a friend of his said, hey, can I pay you to change my brakes? And by the time he went to do the next job, he was much better at it because he had already taught himself how to do it. So it's examples like that that we look for. And again, it's just that skill of self-learning. It doesn't need to have anything to do with design. You don't have to have taught yourself graphic design or coding or anything like that. It's just, are you a self-learner?
It's funny you mentioned the brake example, because I have one friend who changes their own brakes. And his name's Chase. And I met Chase in college. And I went to college. I was a Japanologist, you know, majored in Japanese, of all things. Still a little mad that they let me do that, but I did. but I think the greatest thing I learned wasn't all the Japanese. It was like actually meeting Chase, because Chase was like the smartest person in the world to me. And I was like, hey, why? He just knows everything. And then I slowly figured out he's just actually really good at Googling. And he had like the keywords. He knew how to phrase like a Google, you know, query, right? Like the right keywords, the right kind of number of adjectives, where like I'm typing a book. Like, why on earth are there, I was writing just terrible queries, but he just was very like efficient and succinct. And I just was like, that's how he knows so much. So really? It taught me
his
how
ability
to
change brakes had to do with his ability to kind of Google.
Well,
Google
it just sort of, I think it just, in to my mind, there's like a correlation, just like, well, and now he's so good at Googling. He's just like, well, I'll just learn how, I'll just Google how to change my brakes. Like, I'll just figure that out. Mm-hmm. So I still have not been that motivated, but
I changed the oil on my motorcycle a couple of years ago, and I was pretty impressed with myself.
Well, I've never done any work on my car, if it makes you all feel better. So
I can do that now too. I thought I was inspired by a friend of mine who was like, who went out, and there's like, there's no way this is hard. Like, why would they make, you know, and it just kind of isn't, you know, it's a little fiddly or whatever, but you can absolutely change it. I don't know why I'm so focused on this now, but it is a great correlation, right? If you kind of have a little go-getter spirit on it. Not that I blame anybody for not wanting to do things like this, but there's other examples like that too, right? Like, you could be like, well, I wanted to, I don't know, build a step up thing for my dog to get up onto my bed because she's getting old and I wanted you'd still have to learn. Yeah.
I used to, a few years ago before I worked at Center, I worked with this guy who was just such an incredible self-learner. And he was this modest guy, but he just had so many skills. He went to the Art Institute for graphic design. So he learned graphic design and I think some coding. But on top of that, he taught himself so many coding skills. He knew a lot about front end. He was a good graphic designer. And then when I worked with him, he was really curious about learning UX design and he wanted to work with me on projects. So he just gravitated toward me. I took him under my wing and he just soaked everything up and he approached everything as a challenge. Like, all right, I want to learn this. And he learned it really quickly. And by the time, so he and I worked together for maybe a year and a half. And by the time I left, he was doing usability tests on his own. Like, he was running user research studies on his own because he wanted to learn from me and just approached it with this, you know, just sponge mindset of like, I want to learn this. And what was really cool about that was I realized through working with him that he wasn't necessarily very successful in a conventional educational environment. I know he struggled with reading, and he was honest with me about that. He really struggled with reading. He's probably dyslexic. And, you know, so this was not the typical person who got straight A's in school. And at the same time, he is very successful in this field. He's now a product manager, leading an effort at a different company. And, you know, he was just telling me last time I talked with him how he's reading this book and or going through this book and watching videos on how to get better at product management. And the things that he's telling me were just really great. I said, well, everything that you're telling me is what our students learn in one of the courses that they take, which is basically a product management course. So I'm thinking, you know, this guy, he's just like this insatiable self-learner. And because of that, he's so well-rounded and so capable. And he was one of the first people that I was exposed to who was that extreme about self-learning. And it was so inspiring to me, and it helped me become a better self-learner. So I was like, I want to be like him. You know, I know a lot more about UX than he does, and he's catching up so fast. If he can catch up fast, you know, if other people can do this, I can do this too.
Is it putting him in the situation? Like, here's a non-softball question for you. Like, if somebody's an incredible self-learner already, why do they need Center then? Oh, sorry, but that'd be good to know.
Whoa, hardball. Yeah.
Dun, dun, dun. No, that's a great question. So you can only get so far in UX design without real-world experience. And that's why a lot of hiring managers care about, can you do the work and can you show evidence that you can do the work? I think coding is different. Now, you all know more about, you know, front end than I do, so you may disagree. I do think that coding is a little more straightforward. Yes, you need experience with coding, but it's very cut and dry. There's a lot of it that you can practice and learn on your own. Whereas UX, you can only read about it so much before you actually have to do it and experience it to get that useful knowledge under your belt. It's kind of like cooking. Like, you can watch, like, if you don't know how to cook, you can watch all the cooking shows in the world and you can learn some things, but you won't really know how to cook until you get into the kitchen and until you turn on the stove and try to saute something. You might end up finding that you burn it when you you burned your food. When you, okay, I didn't realize that. Okay, well, turns out the smoke point of butter is really high and they didn't say that on the cooking show, so I just burnt the butter and now my food tastes weird, you know? UX is the same way. Like, you really need real world experience to know how to do it. And that's one of the big reasons why we exist, because as you mentioned before, roughly 2/3 of your time is spent on real project work. So by the time you graduate, you haven't just learned about the skills, you have learned how to do the skills and you can provide evidence of that learning through your portfolio.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think UX has a lot more nuance, or almost like a decision you made 3 weeks ago is now blowing up in your face or something. And you're mm-hmm. like, oh, okay. Now I have to reevaluate kind of the whole cascade of assumptions I made.
So. Yeah. And that the guy, I'm glad this came up because the guy I was talking about a little while ago, the guy who's a super driven self-learner, he was trying to do UX work before I was there. And he was reading articles and doing this and doing that. And he was trying and he just wasn't getting far enough. But with me coming on, I was very senior and I was able to help him see, okay, what you're doing here, part of this you're doing really well. Here's another part that you could do better in order to, you know, for example, get buy-in from the team and move this forward. So he was only able to get himself so far without some sort of mentorship, some sort of way to really know how to apply it on the job.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Discover.bot. Discover.bot is an online community for bot creators designed to serve as a platform-agnostic digital space for bot developers and enthusiasts of all skill levels to learn from one another, share their stories, and move the conversation forward together. Discover.bot was built by Amazon Registry Services, and it's an informational place for novices and experts in the bot development space. Discover.bot regularly publishes how-to guides and the latest bot building resources. Some recent guides are how to design a bot personality, how to set up payments through your bot, and how to stop shopping cart abandonment. Discover.bot also shares expert advice and provides insights on all things bots. For example, what KPIs are worth measuring, why emojis may be breaking your bot, and how to write an engaging chatbot dialogue. They cover all sorts of topics and genres, including bot development, bots for business, chatbot news. If you're new to the bot development space, Discover.bot will teach you everything there is to know about bots. There's a guide called Beginner's Guide to Bots, which will teach you how bots were invented, the basics of how bots work, what bots can do, and where bots are developed and published. And if you've already got a few bots of your own, Discover.bot can help you choose a framework that's aligned with your business. For example, e-commerce, travel, finance, hospitality, and more. They've got a great guide just for you called Guide to Bot Building Frameworks. From NLU features to platform connectors to APIs, there's a lot to consider. Find out what all the major frameworks have to offer so you can choose a chatbot framework that fits your objectives. To find out more, go to discover.bot/shoptalk so they'll know you came from us and check out discover.bot. Our thanks to discover.bot for sponsoring Shop Talk Show.
Kind of the inverse question, how do you spot a non-self-learner? And is it, I guess, you know, we're speaking very fondly of self-learning and maybe some listeners are like, I don't have that gene, you know, is it a problem or is it maybe kind of a problem in our industry or, you know, like, I guess, like, how do you spot a non-self-learner? And then like, you know, is it okay if somebody isn't in our industry?
I think it's okay. You know, I don't think, I mean, I'm not going to stand up here and be like, you must be a self-learner. I think if you don't have that skill, you're not going to get nearly as far in your career as if you had it. For sure. Just with the examples I've just shared, you know, the guy I was talking about, had he not had those skills, like he'd probably still be doing the graphic design that he learned how to do in school, which is fine. He just wouldn't be where he wants to be. And he wouldn't have had the amazing career that he has now.
I'd say half the work I do at least is a totally unknown territory. It's like, I know what needs to be done and I have no idea how to do it. And I have to just figure it out somehow, but I'm usually not too stressed out about it because my skills over the years have lent themselves to like, well, here we go again. I guess I'll look for some docs and see if I can read through them. But docs sometimes suck. So I'll try some trial and error and I'll reach my network and ask for questions and I'll try to compare it to some other code. I'll look, try to find some examples out there. Well, of course, my mind jumps to coding problems, but that's not always true. Sometimes there's other tasks that are similar in that way. But yeah, I would say that if working with me on the projects I work on, if I was hiring someone to help me with that, you can't not be a self-learner. If I found that you just had some specific thing that you knew how to do and what you wanted to do in life was just execute that skill that you already had, you're going to be useless to me. I hate to say it.
Yeah. I mean, like I was saying earlier, I agree with everything you've said. I think it really sets you apart when you're a self-learner. And again, if any of your listeners are thinking, well, I don't have that skill, you know, you can always start small and start building the muscle, just like you would if you wanted to run a marathon. You got to start with the first mile.
I'm just thinking about myself because I do that. But I'm thinking like it's, yeah, I feel very much like self-learner, but I also like know like, oh, this industry likes to reinvent itself every 6 months or so and come up with something totally new that we must be doing. And then you have to have an opinion on it because your client or your boss or whoever starts asking you like, hey, can we do the parallax? And you're like, oh, no. I'm in the like.
Are you trying to say that it'd be cool? Though. Maybe we should have more set skills than if you're.
Well, yeah, or I'm, I don't know. Or I keep coming back to like we need like budgeted time to like think about these things, you know, and to continue self learning, you know. But I think a lot of us are stuck in like sprints, you know, and you're just like, you know, 26 sprints a year, just break my neck all year. And then,
you know, for years on this show, we've said our little tagline is, and feel free to play it, Chris Enns, is just build websites, which is our kind of cheesy way of answering the question, what should I learn next? Because we get that question over and over and over and over and over. I'm sure you're kind of obliged to have an answer to that for your students at school. So it'd be interesting to hear what you have to say about that. But also that we say it just because it's like, I don't know what to tell you. You should learn what the project you're on dictates you learn next, because that has all that real world vibe to it that's going to mimic what you need to know when you're progressing in your career and getting new jobs and all that. That's why we say that.
Exactly. I agree with that. And one of the things I've told my students and I've told other people is that I've learned from a guy named Chris Resden, who's like a prototyping expert and a UX expert here in the field. He was teaching prototyping workshops at our conferences a few years ago. And people, you know, so in the UX field, there's so many different prototyping tools. There's a ton of them, and there are always new ones coming out. And people often would go up to him and ask him, you know, what prototyping tool should I learn now? And his response was always, well, instead of focusing on what tool you should learn next, focus on learning how to learn the tools as quickly and as effectively as you can, because the tools are always going to change. So if you learn Sketch or if you learn Framer or whatever mm-hmm. tool is really popular right now, chances are in a year, you're going to have to learn a new tool because that tool is not going to be the tool of choice anymore. Or you might switch a job and they use completely different tools. Or you might start a new project where the tool that you were using before just isn't a good fit for this project. So that really resonated with me. It made a ton of sense to me. Like, rather than spending all your energy on trying to get good at one tool, really, like we were saying earlier, really focusing on, you know, well, how can I get better at learning? And the next time you learn a tool, maybe even taking some notes on how you learn, or just being really mindful of how you learn, reflecting even. So the next time you have to learn something, you will have, you know, you'll have thought about it before.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like, because maybe even the fourth time you learn something, you still like a wave of terror may befall you yet again. That's like, oh, I don't know how to do this, you know? At least that's what my body does. Like, you know? But if I was like, okay, I've done this three times before, and before I had a little bit of methodology on how I got past this, maybe I'll just try to apply that same type of thinking to this new unknown.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And our students, they encountered that on their projects. So each project required different tools, usually for different reasons. Sometimes they were doing low fidelity prototypes. So there are tools that are more suited for low fidelity prototypes. Sometimes they had to make a certain type of prototype and hand it off to the design team, and the design team had these specific needs. So I think they use some of the same tools some of the time, but with each project, they always had to learn at least one new tool. And again, that's reality. And that's, you know, kind of building upon everything I've said before, that's one of the reasons why we focus so much on self-learning when we interview our applicants and when they go for the, through the admissions process, because it's something that they're going to have to do even here at Center. And again, when they graduate and go off to work.
That's a big deal, isn't it? That final push out the door, you know? There's probably, and so it's, you, I don't know, probably somewhat unique to Center because you've known them for 2 years. And so you can, I don't know, guide them, be like, remember when you did this, this, and this, tell the world, that kind of thing. But mm-hmm. What about more generally than that? What are you trying to, I don't know, you know, when these students or anybody who's looking for a new job or perhaps their first job or entering the industry, like what's the, everybody wants to know this. Anybody in that position is just thirsty for knowledge on like, how can I present myself in the best way that this is actually going to work?
Yeah, that's a really big question. Yeah, there's so many ways I could answer that. So are you saying like if somebody, you know, just recently realized like, hey, UX is what I want to do, or, you know, front end development is what I want to do. Like, you know, what would I say to that person who's asking me like, how, you know, how can I make myself stand out and be hireable?
Well, but I guess to go from that early stages of I'm going to make the leap and I want to do this thing for real. And now you kind of have, because perhaps you've attended Center or you've done a ton of learning on your own, or you've built up some sites you've built and that kind of thing. But you have not yet, I don't know, made it to your to your satisfaction in the industry. Because what you really want is to like go work at Airbnb or something, you know. How do you get there, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I know that's a big question, but
I want the money. I want the SV bucks.
That's what people want. They want to come to work at 10 a.m. They want free gummy worms, and they want to wear sweatpants.
And venture capital.
And they want over $100,000 a year.
Yeah. Oh, geez. There's so much I could say about this. But I will say with our students, one of the things that we do with them is from the beginning of the two-year program, we work with them on preparing ahead of time for their job search. So what we want to avoid is it's a year and a half into the program, or maybe a year and 9 months into the program, and then they're like, oh, I got to put a portfolio together. Oh, I got to do a resume. Oh, I got to think back to what I did a year ago at Center, that old project. It's been a year. I can't really remember what I did, but I got to put it on my resume. So now I got to, you know, put on my thinking cap and get back in a time machine and try to go back and figure it out. So that's the situation that we want to avoid. And that's the situation that a lot of professionals find themselves in when they're ready to look for new work, where, you know, they've been in a job for 2 years, 3 years, even more, and now they have to put a portfolio together or a resume, and they can't remember what they did 2 months ago, let alone 2 years ago. So we work with the students pretty early on about crafting a career management document that they keep up to date. And that's a document where you capture all the project work that you're doing on a regular basis. You can do it every day. You can do it once a week. I do it, and I do it once a week.
What did you call that document again?
The career management document.
I love this. Mm-hmm. So you don't like forget about little moments that
exactly.
are...
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, it's fresh in your mind and it doesn't take that long. It takes me maybe 20 to 30 minutes a week, depending on what I've done that week. And what I do is I just capture notes about what I did, photographs. So I'll take photographs of, you know, sticky notes on the wall. I often ask people here at Center to take photographs of me if I'm leading a meeting or if I'm up at the whiteboard, I'll ask my colleagues to do that. So I save those. And I also just write up resume bullets and I put them in this long running document. I have this Google Doc that's probably like 20 pages long now, but it's just a long running list of projects that I've done and potential resume bullets I could use. So
talked on Shop Talk Show, April 24th.
Yeah, I do. Next. I actually put like podcast interviews in there because you never know what you're going to need for your next job, right? I even help out with social media sometimes here at Center, especially now that we're in between student cohorts. And I put the social media work that I've done on there because I don't plan to go into social media marketing, but you never know like what is going to be applicable to your next job. So that's what we tell our students is capture everything that you do. And it's been incredibly useful for me. in all sorts of ways. Even like I blog a lot, and sometimes I want to write about a project that I worked on 6 months or a year ago. So I'll even go back into the career management document just to refresh myself on what I did on that project so that I can write about it in the blog post. But more importantly, it's really so that you have a record of everything that you've done and that you've already done a lot of the legwork. So by the time you go to apply for a new job, you know, you're not starting from zero. And heaven forbid you get laid off or fired from your job. I mean, that happens. I've seen good people get fired. I've seen good people get laid off. It can happen to anybody. You're going to be in a really stressful situation. You're going to be panicking, and you don't want to be in that situation and starting from scratch and trying to put a resume together from zero and a portfolio, where if you've already done some of that legwork, especially if it's a stressful situation and you're scrambling to find a new job, you'll be very thankful that you did all that work.
Yeah. You don't want to be like fired and then have to spend a month getting your resume or your website resume
exactly
back up and going, mm-hmm. and then like go into work. Yeah.
Yeah.
Our company does this on our about page. We're only three people, so it's pretty easy to collect little facts. But then I do it on my site too, like my about page.
I was just going to say that your about page is great, Dave. It's like this year by year horizontal scrolling, kind of looks like a Trello board of stuff you've done.
Stuff I've done, yeah. Basically. Mm-hmm. And all it is on the back end is just like a data like .yaml file or whatever, like events.yaml. And I just, it has a title and an icon and a year and I just kind of loop through it all. So mm-hmm. it's, so if I ever like, I'm on this podcast every week, so I don't like document all this, but if I'm on somebody else's podcast or I'm on at a conference, or if I get published in another blog or something, I'll just make a little note, because it's just kind of a fun thing for me to keep track of. So, mm-hmm.
Projects, it's interesting how you put some of these on here, Dave, but they're maybe not like, I feel like this would be twice as big if it was like client projects launched.
Yeah. If it was like every project, it'd be pretty big, but I just tried to get the big ones, in there.
Yeah.
So just kind of the,
you have a secret redacted one, January 2018.
Guess we'll never know.
Yeah. And I'm so glad that I do it for myself, and we have our students do it, and it's been a tremendous help to them. And one thing that I wanted to add too, is that I think it's important to, when you're capturing all this evidence of your work, that you want to capture evidence from each stage of the project. Because some folks especially who are new to UX design, they think that for their portfolio, they need finished screenshots of their work, and that's all that goes into the portfolio. But there's much more that needs to go into the portfolio. Most good hiring managers, they want to see, for each project in your portfolio, they want to see what was the project like. So what stages did you go through? What problems did you encounter in the project? And how did you overcome those problems? What technical constraints did you have? What was your timeline? What was your budget? All of those things. And they really want to see a story. So they want to see a progression of how this project started, the process that you went through, and what the end result was. So it's really important, too, to capture evidence of the work as you go through the project. So that could be screenshots of some prototypes that you make. It could be photos of some sketches that you made early in the process. It could even be photos of you moderating a usability test. So anything that you think might be useful for your career management document later, go ahead and capture it. Because the worst that can happen is it doesn't take much time. Like I said, it only takes, a half an hour a week or less. The worst that can happen is you capture something that you don't need later, but you don't want to be in the opposite situation where you wish you had gotten photos of you running a usability test and now you don't have any, and that would be perfect for your portfolio and now you don't have any. So you just want to avoid that if you can.
Oh, that's good advice.
I'd be impressed by that photo. Like I can see that, that you'd be like, well, I did, but that thing never really launched, or when it did launch, it didn't really use a lot of the stuff that we did or whatever. I'm like, so what? Who cares? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You still did the work.
Well, and mm-hmm. so often especially at digital products, it's like the version you launched only existed for one day, like, and then, the next day 20 requests for marketing show up and you're just like, oh boy, like let's take them one at a time and murder the website. But that's fine. You know, it happens.
That's a good point. Paul Boag has a great quote that I love, and it's something along the lines of, launching a website is like planting a garden. Like, you don't plant the garden and then just walk away for weeks at a time and expect it to flourish. Like, you have to maintain it. You have to prune it. You have to water it. You have to keep an eye on it, you know, in case all the squirrels are eating your flowers or whatever. And a website is the same way. Like, when you launch, that's not the end, right? It's just the start of the next phase of pruning the website, keeping it active, and getting requests from stakeholders who want more things on the website or want more things to change. So I love that. That was a huge thing for me. I've shared that with my students as well.
I like that. There's so many good metaphors. Robin Rendall, just over on CSS Tricks, wrote one about how a website is a car and not a book. I think there's some people that think of a book as like you craft it so perfectly and you get all the stuff just right and then you send it to the world and you're done. And the metaphor holds up in a way because it is a reading experience. A lot of websites are, you know, it's a lot of typography and that. And so you get to compare it to a book isn't so bad, but he's like, no, it's just much more than that. All these little parts that got to work together and that change over time and that need to be tested and yada, yada, yada. So also,
and there's recalls because some of the parts blow up. So you have to like take care of that.
Yeah. I love this metaphor. Yeah. Or like me, there's a giant puddle on the highway that you drive through and it tears apart the bottom of your car. So now you got to fix it. I've had terrible soon, luck with cars. I have this awful like rain cloud, you know, that you see in cartoons with the rain cloud with the lightning that follows. That's how I am with cars. It's like, and I'm not reckless with my cars at all. I don't do donuts in the parking lot. I drive through giant puddles and then it costs me $500 to fix them. But anywho, tangent. But anyway, I love that metaphor though. That's great. I love when you first brought up the book, I thought you were going to say a website is not a book. It's not like something you finish and then you put it away. But I love the fact, but you're talking more about almost like the publishing or the writing and the publishing nature of the book. But either way, I really love that metaphor. That's great.
I want to kickstart a web design metaphor book, coffee table book. And it's just all of these. Because for us, it's like, it's similar to the garden. And maybe if we translate British English to American English, it's exactly the same thing. But we always call it mowing the lawn. You know, it's like, well, like we can do a major UX overhaul, but like we kind of got to mow the lawn first see what's in the yard. you know, like we just have to clean it up and then we can kind of address the fundamental.
And there's 100% you know? Chance that you're going to need to mow it again in a week.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Dave, I love that
but
idea.
But at least now you know there's like a snake pit in the yard, and there's, you know, or an old jungle gym or something. You
know? Did somebody really drive by and push their old washer and dryer under my front yard? Oh my God.
Why is there a baby stroller from the 1950s?
Oh, that's great. I love the idea of your coffee table book, Dave. I think you should run with that. That's awesome.
Yeah, just take every metaphor to its like most logical extreme. Yeah.
I hear a book apart is interested.
Yeah, really? Because they shut me down. All right, I'll get Cattell on the phone.
This episode is brought to you in part by WooCommerce. Today, I want to tell you about three exciting updates to WooCommerce. The first one is that WooCommerce version 3.6 shipped recently and added product blocks. So you can build rich pages with blocks in sites running WordPress version 5 or higher that show products by category, best-selling products, hand-picked products, newest products, and products with specific attributes and more. Super handy if you're using the new Gutenberg WordPress editor. The second cool WooCommerce update is the new WooCommerce mobile app for iOS and Android. You can track your store to see which products are performing best, check revenue, view and manage orders, and get real-time alerts notifying you about store activity like new orders or reviews. So be sure to search for WooCommerce mobile app on the iOS App Store or Google Play today. Finally, if you're running a WooCommerce site right now, you should check out the new Dashboard for WooCommerce Admin that the team released as a feature plugin. It's what's going to eventually be the default dashboard in WooCommerce, but you can check it out right now. You get all sorts of data and analytics on your WooCommerce store with a completely customizable dashboard, new reports, and a new activity panel to alert you to what's happening right now in your WooCommerce store. And if you'd like to see a WooCommerce store in operation, go check out the CodePen shop at blog.codepen.io/shop and try ordering yourself a shirt. The CodePen shop is running on WooCommerce. And the shirt is one of my favorite shirts that I wear each week. Our thanks to WooCommerce for sponsoring this episode of Shop Talk Show.
Okay, so what is, you know, your do you want to tell us a little bit more about the kind of the curriculum situation at Center Center and how that you've arrived at that and how it evolves and that type of thing?
Sure. So we always saw our curriculum as this living and evolving document because the industry evolves and changes all the time. So we want our curriculum to stay current and evolve with it. So we just graduated our first class of students in October, and we have not started our next class yet. So we are taking this time to take a deep dive into the curriculum and looking at what's working from the first cohort that we want to keep and what we want to evolve and adjust to keep up with the demands of the industry. One of the things that we've heard from hiring managers, we started hearing it a lot shortly before students graduated, is that UX hiring managers want UX designers who have more visual design skills. And that wasn't something that we were hearing 2 years prior when we were finalizing the curriculum. But it's something that we were hearing a lot. We talked with these hiring managers, and by visual design skills, these hiring managers, they weren't looking for UX designers to make logos or, you know, rebrand companies or anything like that. They want UX designers who can work with a brand style guide and work with a design system and put together a high fidelity functional prototype that uses the principles of graphic design, color, type, and layout that will hold up and adhere to the brand guidelines and everything, rather than having to rely on a visual designer to do that work. There's a lot of that type of work happening now in companies. So UX hiring managers are looking for designers who have those skills. Now, we already had visual design in our curriculum. We had one class. Dan Mall actually came in and taught the workshop for that class. And we realized that while it gave the students a foundation, it wasn't giving them enough for what the hiring managers need now. So now we are looking for ways to add more visual design to the curriculum, possibly another course. And we are also looking, in the future, we'll be looking for more project opportunities, more projects that give students opportunities to do more visual design work. So that's just one example of how we're evolving the curriculum. Another way, too, is that we're taking a deep dive and looking back into what more accessibility and inclusion achievements we can add into the curriculum. So we believe in weaving accessibility into all of the courses because we believe that accessibility is something that needs to be considered at every stage of the project. As you all know, it's best to weave accessibility into the design from day one, all the way from day one of, you know, thinking about what the project's going to be until it launches and beyond. So we infuse accessibility into each of our courses. And we make sure that we do that instead of making it a separate thing. Because what you don't want to do in a project is to say, okay, we're 3/4 of the way through the project. Now let's stop and see how we can make it accessible. Because chances are it's you've done all this work already. And it's probably not accessible, and it's extremely hard to retrofit a design and make it accessible.
It is kind of sometimes the drizzle stage, right? Like the pizza comes out of the oven, and you're just like, I'm gonna drizzle out a little accessibility and then ship it out the door.
Yeah, if only it were that easy, right? But it's very, very difficult to make something accessible in that way. Speaking of metaphors, Nick Steinhout, he runs the Accessibility Rules podcast. He has a great quote. He said, if you're going to make blueberry muffins, you can't add the blueberries to the muffins after they're baked. You have to add them in from the beginning. Same thing with accessibility. It's really, really hard to retrofit a design and make it accessible. And it's usually very expensive and time consuming at that point. But if you weave it in from the beginning, chances are you will have a much more accessible product. So that's why we weave accessibility into each of our courses, and we're taking a deep dive and looking at additional ways that we can infuse accessibility into each course.
And even, I mean, this is right up my alley here, just looking at my Jira board. But yeah, it's like even like component driven design and learning how to do that means like, oh, you can fix accessibility issues at a component level and then roll out the new component, updated component. So I think it pays like, yeah, accessibility. So it's another garden, right? It's you can't just like, I find a lot of people just want a binary answer. Like, is this accessible? Yes or no. And you're like, well, so it depends on what you mean. Like, can a screen reader read it? Yeah. Is it like hard to understand if you're like dyslexic and autistic? Maybe. Yeah. We'd have to investigate, you know, like you're just, it's, you know, people just want it, they don't understand the continuous practice nature of accessibility. You know, it's kind of just a, they just want a binary yes or no, is it done sort of thing. And I struggle with that, but I would, I think people need to understand it's kind of an ongoing thing.
Yeah. And I like that you brought that up because I think there's a misconception out there that accessibility is about screen readers and making our designs work for screen readers. And that's part of accessibility, but there's so much more to accessibility. So accessibility is not just for people who have visual impairment or people who are blind who use a screen reader. You can think about people who have low literacy, right? Because the statistics are pretty astounding here in the U.S. and probably around the world, where there are many people who are virtually illiterate, very low literacy, who really struggle to read.
Whoa, and I don't know that much about this. This is interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm following what you're saying, but I never connected like low literacy with like an accessibility concern.
Yeah. So it really, what that affects is the content that you write for the website. Because if you're using jargon, if you're using really complex words where you could be using simple words instead, it's going to be very difficult for that person to understand the information that you're putting out there. And really it's up to us as designers to meet the user where they're at. So if the user has low literacy, it's not up to us to be like, well, suffer through and, you know, read this, you know, college level writing, when we could simplify the writing and make it open it up and make it more accessible to that person. And by simplifying your writing, by the way, it doesn't mean dumbing down. A lot of people push back and say, well, I'm not going to dumb down my writing. I don't want to insult my readers who can read at a higher level. But by making your writing simple and your content simple, you're not dumbing it down. You're opening it up to more people who can read it. And by simplifying the language, you're actually making it much easier to understand, even for people who have a higher reading level. So it's less cognitive processing that they have to do to understand the content.
Oh, preach it. So great.
Yeah.
You know, I connect. This isn't 100% connected, but a little bit in that I've had people reach out to me at CSS Tricks and be like, I want to write an article. Is this too beginnery? I said, absolutely not. I love beginner style articles, but I will tell you that a beginner style article, the bar is higher still than an advanced article. An advanced article is fine. It's complicated. You break it into parts. You do your best explaining it and people will follow along and hopefully eventually understand your complicated thing. But when you're explaining a simple thing, a foundational kind of concept, you really have to avoid anything, too many assumptions, and just make it super, super clear. And and then when you're done, it doesn't mean that the target for that article is just only people at the exact beginner article that I've heard. I can't remember who I'm stealing this from, people of all skill levels will enjoy a piece of well-written beginner content because they'll, you know, nod their head along with it and appreciate the clarity that you've brought to something that is kind of near and dear to their heart. And then beginners will get it as well. So anyway, just a little aside.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, very similar.
Mm-hmm. It also reminds me of a website, which is an old website that I think is one of the greatest treasures of the internet ever, is unsuck-it.com.
Oh, which is, I vaguely remember this. Yeah. Okay, yeah. This sounds familiar. Okay.
It's just a huge list of stupid business jargon words. Not all business, but just all, you know, like, I don't know. There's just a million of them alternatives to the stupid jargon, you know? And there just must be hundreds or a thousand stupid things in here. And it's like, just don't use that word. Just use a clear word instead.
It really has
like a intense vibe to it. What were you saying?
Yeah, we talk about that at Center. Like, we talk about using the word, instead of using the word leverage, just use the word use. Or instead of using the word utilize, just use the word use.
There you go.
Stuff like that. Even I remember working on projects where there was one project where we were redesigning a hospital's website. It was the public consumer-facing website. And we found that some people struggled to know what a cardiologist was. But if we replaced the term cardiologist with heart doctor, everybody knew what that was. So we had a lot of conversations, you know, and of course, not everything's cut
that
and dry.
That might even get me. I'd be like, is that the skin one or whatever? No?
Yeah, like the...
Radiologist. My radio's fine. It's my bones that are broken.
Yeah, and who's going to be offended? Oh, they said heart doctor when they could have used a more complicated word. Nobody cares. Shut up. It's a heart doctor.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, Chris, because you have to balance everything with what the user needs and also the politics of the organization you're working in and the business goals and everything. So I don't remember if we ended up with heart doctor. I think it's something that we recommended. It might have stayed cardiologist. Mm. But, you know, you do what you can to get the design through the door and you know, you have some wins for the user and you have, you know, some losses and it is what it is. But it was another interesting project actually was when I was working at Happy Cog and we were redesigning the Holocaust Museum's website. So it's a museum dedicated to the World War II and the Holocaust that is in Washington, D.C. And when we were doing usability testing on that, so the museum does a lot of awareness work on modern genocide, modern mass murder that happens around the world. And we found that with our users, some of them didn't understand the word genocide, but they understood the term mass murder. So again, that was another conversation. I know this is a really depressing example, but it's a good example of how to simplify language. I mean, it gave us the opportunity to have a conversation with the client about, you know, what language do we want to use to make sure that this information is as understandable as possible.
That's just a great example of accessibility. And we were kind of talking about accessibility. Did we derail you in a way? Do you have more to say about that?
No, this is all about accessibility. I mean, it comes in so many forms. You know, also, so for example, we have a presenting course here at Center, and one of the things that students learn in the course is, you know, if you're giving a presentation and someone in your audience has trouble hearing, you know, how do you make your presentation accessible to that person? Or if somebody in the presentation has a visual impairment, somebody in the audience has a visual impairment, how do you make that presentation accessible to them? And there are all sorts of things you can do, everything from little things you can do with if you're presenting slides to, you know, hiring a sign language interpreter. But if there's somebody in the audience who has trouble hearing, you can make sure that you're using a microphone, number one. You can add some just small text labels to your slides. And you can do it in a way that just clarifies what's on the slide for everybody in the audience. And it's not just helping the person who has trouble hearing. It's, you know, I remember one of my students was giving a presentation. It was a practice presentation for the presenting course. And she was presenting about how she likes to knit. And she showed this knitted sweater. It was a picture of the sweater that she had knitted on the screen. And it was a sweater that she had knitted for her friend's dog. But I thought it was a baby sweater. And then I was confused. And then at the end of the presentation, when we were reflecting on the presentation, she talks about, oh, that sweater for my friend's dog. And I was like, oh, I had no idea. I was confused. I'm like, well, I thought it was for a baby. And then, so one of the techniques, there are lots of techniques that you can use. You can just take a moment to say, like, as you're going through the presentation, I knitted this sweater for my friend's dog. Or you can even have a label on there or something that says, you know, dog sweater or something like that. You know, and it makes the content more understandable for everybody and not just the person who might have a disability, like trouble hearing or trouble seeing.
Yeah, love it.
Great. I guess we're kind of hitting towards the end of the show here. Maybe one last question would be like, if somebody's like, hey, I do want to like make the move into being a UX front end UX designer, like how do I... like any, I guess, pre-center work that they can do, is there anything you would recommend them kind of taking on or kind of looking at doing?
So, of course, I should say that we are accepting applications for the next cohort. So if you are interested in Center, please feel free to reach out to me. I'm very easy to find and contact online. And in addition to that, Center aside, maybe one of the big things I would say is just prepare yourself for having a lot to learn. Like there are many people who transition their careers and they do so successfully. There's just so much to learn about UX design, and just prepare yourself and be kind to yourself that it's going to take a while to really learn everything that you need to know to have a like a fairly solid foundation. It can take people years into their careers before they really get a solid foundation. And even then some, like lots of time. So hopefully that makes sense. I think some people get really excited about UX design and they want to get into it. And then the more they learn about it, the more they learn they don't know. And it can seem very scary. But we all had to start from somewhere. So I would say if you want to be a UX designer, just kind of prepare yourself for having a lot to learn and give yourself permission to learn and fumble, and you will get there.
That's a wonderful wrapping up sentiment. Thank you, Jessica.
Yeah, thank you, Jessica. And so we'll do our standard wrap up, but thank you very much for coming and sharing about kind of learning to learn. I love the discussion personally, but for those who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
So I write on Medium, so feel free to follow me there. I blog there pretty regularly. I'm also very active on Twitter. I'm constantly reading UX articles and reviewing resources, and I share the best of what I find on Twitter. So if you're interested in following me there, please feel free to do so. And otherwise, those are probably the two best places to find me.
Awesome. Well, thank you. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. I'm sure you enjoyed my sultry voice this episode. So hopefully it'll be better next one. And follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. Star Heart, favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. And
hey, Shop Talks folks, you looking for a job? We got a good one to shout out for you. This is in Baltimore, Maryland, at an agency called Vitamin. It's kind of a WordPress shop, or they love WordPress anyway. So if you have a WordPress experience, that's great. But it's a front-end position, so HTML, CSS, JavaScript, jQuery, responsive design, those kind of things. The more you know about typography, the better. You have a little React and Vue experience, all the better. Are you into JavaScript animation libraries? Ooh, fun. Things like GreenSock, all the better. So it's in Baltimore, Maryland. The parking is ample. The coffee is good. Looks like a great job. They're looking for, people like you, people that like this show. So good luck. Apply at Vitamin today.
And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
ChopDuckShow.com.